the idea is truly is to work on building up the grassroots effort a lot earlier. So I'm started now instead of a couple months before the primary.
Don Young's competition for next year's election. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, using solar energy year-round in Alaska.
With this building addition, our goal was to run it completely without fossil fuels.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
With the control of Congress in the balance, the Alaska Senate race is expected to be one of the more high-profile races in the country. The Republican National Committee has gotten involved, and veterans of the Romney and McCain presidential campaigns are already working to unseat Democrat Mark Begich. But what about the House race? The odds may be long, but APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that two Democrats are already competing for the chance to take on Don Young.
Don Young has held the title of Congressman for All Alaska for 40 years. There's a reason he's earned the nickname Teflon Don. Gas, changing political tides, federal investigations, nothing sticks. In the past two decades, Ethan Berkowitz is the candidate who has come closest to beating him in the general election. He had the support of the National Democratic Party back in 2008, and Berkowitz still lost by 5 points.
He's the uncle who say the outrageous things. And you're like, oh, there goes Uncle Don again. But it's Uncle Don.
The past two elections, Young won by more than 30 points, and both of his opponents filed for office pretty late in the game. But this go-round, there's not one, but two Democrats who have already filed and are starting to fundraise on the normal election calendar. Forrest Dunbar is one of them.
There's been a couple of cycles where the Democrats were perceived as putting up sacrificial lambs. I actually think that some of those representatives some of those Democrat candidates would have been fine congresspeople. But when you want to run a serious campaign today, especially a statewide campaign in a place like Alaska, you have to start early.
Dunbar is 29 years old, and this is his first time running for office. He split his childhood between Eagle and Cordova, and he came back to Alaska after spending some time in the Peace Corps, in law school, and on Capitol Hill. Part of the reason he's running now is because of frustration with a highly polarized Congress. Dunbar says he knows it's an uphill battle. He's only raised about $20,000 so far. Young has more than $500,000 in his campaign account, and he represents the dominant party in the state. But Dunbar thinks that with all the attention on the Senate race, there might be space to experiment with his campaign strategy and make inroads that way.
Some of the more traditional forms of media, which are traditionally where you spend a lot of that money, are going to be purchased up by the Senate campaigns. So $600,000 sounds like a lot, but it's going to pale in comparison to the $20 or $30 million that are going to be spent on either side of the Senate campaign. And I think that sort of creates an opportunity to run a more grassroots campaign, to run a more social media-oriented campaign, to connect with voters in different ways.
Matt Moore is the other Democrat to file. He actually tried to get his party's nomination in 2012. But he started his campaign late and lost out to state legislator Sharon Cisna. When it comes to strategy, his angle is similar to Dunbar's.
The idea is truly is to work on building up the grassroots effort a lot earlier. So I'm started now instead of a couple of months before the primary.
Moore is 53 and works as a healthcare administrator. He's critical of Young's leadership abilities and his attendance, and he's hoping low approval of Congress works in his favor. Moore says even though he lost the primary last time, he learned a few lessons about running a campaign. He's scheduling fundraisers right now, and he's got half a dozen staff and volunteers helping out with his campaign. Their big goal at the moment is simply introducing Moore to voters.
We're working on the deficit of name recognition. I don't think you can do that in a real short period of time in a state this large.
As a veteran candidate, Berkowitz says that both Moore and Dunbar have their work cut out for them. He thinks the Senate race
is going to bury everything here
in terms of money, attention, and press coverage, and that
having run three Democratic primaries, primaries suck.
Berkowitz says that having a contested primary means spending money fighting someone who's effectively on your team and opening yourself up to serious attacks before the real campaign has even started. He doesn't think having Democratic competition will have some secret benefit of bringing attention to the House race.
There is no benefit at all to the Democrats having a primary. I mean, it's good in terms of being able to develop a coherent Democratic philosophy. But in terms of keeping an eye on the final prize of winning against Don Young, I don't see how this serves that purpose.
Still, Berkowitz is glad to see people in this race already. That's the point of democracy, after all. Plus, strange things can happen in politics, especially if you have an operation in place to leverage it.
Winning means being opportunistic for these guys. And they've got to put all the mechanisms in place so that if an opportunity does materialize, they can take advantage of it.
As for Don Young's thoughts on all this, his campaign did not respond to a request for comment. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks moved ahead yesterday on a project that will demonstrate how solar energy can be collected year-round and used to heat a commercial building without fossil fuels like heating oil. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the project is being funded by one of the world's biggest fossil fuel companies.
Workers spray foam insulation onto a cylindrical steel tank the size of a school bus that's dangling from a big crane just outside the Cold Climate Housing Research Center's office on Fairbanks's west side. A few minutes later, the crane operator swings the 40-foot-long tank into its final resting place, a big trench that was excavated Tuesday on the west side of the building. It's all part of a demonstration project that center research engineer Bruno Grunau says will demonstrate how solar energy can be collected and stored year-round in these northerly latitudes and used to heat a commercial-sized structure. In this case, the center's just completed 8,000-square-foot addition.
With this building addition, our goal was to run a completely without fossil fuels. And so our approach of doing that was, one, using a pellet boiler, and two, supplementing that heat with this solar thermal system.
The big tank, donated by Fairbanks entrepreneur Bernie Carl, is coated with 6 inches of polyurethane foam and will be covered with about 3 feet of soil, then filled with 25,000 gallons of water. Next spring, it'll be hooked up to an automated solar thermal system that's been installed in the addition. The system will circulate fluid that's been warmed in an array of 16 solar heating panels on the building's rooftop to the tank, and the water will store the heat collected from the panels, heat that can be later used to warm the building.
We can manage that heat. We can either send the heat to the building directly, or we can send it to that tank. And when the time comes where the sun's not putting so much heat out, we can pull the heat from the tank and then put it right back into our building.
It's an impressive system using technology that's been around a while. But what distinguishes this project is that the system will be fully instrumented, meaning sensors have been placed throughout to monitor how it's functioning. Grunau says that'll help center staff determine how the technology is working, and it'll provide real-time data that the center will share online.
We're going to be able to put it up on a website so that anyone anywhere around the world can pull up, look at our system and say, hey, this is what they're doing today. This is what the energy flow did. This is how much heat they made. This is how many BTUs they made this year, this month.
Center Director Jack Hebert says the project is another effort to research ways that Alaskans can heat their homes in an economical and renewable way.
Of course, as the state of Alaska's Housing Research Center, it's really our responsibility to explore anything that's available that may help decrease the energy costs for people in the state. And the sun, of course, is a potential resource.
Hebert says it's noteworthy that this $65,000 renewable energy project was funded through a grant from one of the world's biggest fossil fuel producers, BP Alaska.
I think that it's very encouraging to see BP, a company that's normally associated with the drilling and sale of fossil fuels, to support renewable energy. And this, we hope, will be an example of a sustainable approach to a building that uses no fossil fuels at all.
You can find out more about the project at the center's website, cchrc.org. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
47,000 Alaskans registered for an earthquake preparedness event today called the Great Alaska Shakeout. The state spokesman for the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Jeremy Zedek, says it's good that a large number of Alaskans registered to practice the drill.
The recommended action is to drop down to the ground, find some sturdy cover, and hold on to that cover to make sure you don't bounce away or the cover doesn't bounce away.
People who signed up were instructed to practice the drill at exactly 10:17 this morning. Sort of like a flash mob for disaster preparedness, millions of people registered for similar events today across the world. Zedek says because Alaska has experienced 3 of the 6 largest earthquakes ever recorded, it's good for Alaskans to be ready for the next major event. He says another shakeout drill is scheduled for the 50th anniversary of the 9.2 Good Friday earthquake that shook for more than 4 minutes on March 27th, 1964.
Often when we talk to those 1964 earthquake survivors, it's a real changing point in their lives. So we're very susceptible to earthquakes here. It's good for people to prepare and know what to do when they hit.
Zedek says developing a family plan for how to handle a seismic disaster and the aftermath is important. Links to the shakeout and the state's site for emergency planning is at our website, alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state considers air quality regulations for Fairbanks.
Instead of putting the money into cutting people's survival, burning wood to survive, we need to put energy into finding out some different means of heating our houses.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
There was a big turnout in North Pole last night for a Department of Environmental Conservation open house on proposed fine particulate pollution regulations. As KUAC's Dan Brass reports, opinions are mixed on whether they do too much or not enough.
Wood burning is a means of survival in the interior, but the smoke it produces is toxic at high concentrations, and the Environmental Protection Agency is pressing the state to come up with ways of reducing pollution in the Fairbanks area. The proposals include a pollution threshold, which could trigger a wood burning ban for people with alternative heating methods. North Pole resident and wood burner Andrea Sonicson thinks the government has its priorities wrong.
Instead of putting the money into cutting people's survival, burning wood to survive, we need to put energy into finding out some different means of heating our houses.
Sonicson says she and her husband installed a clean burning wood stove and are concerned they won't be able to use it when cold air inversions trap smoke at ground level. The proposed regulations reflect research that shows fine particulate pollution, including wood smoke, can cause serious health problems. But Sonicson, a stay-at-home mom, says she's not concerned.
When it's really cold outside, you aren't outside running a lot anyway, you aren't doing that stuff, you're surviving. It's cold here in Alaska, and that's kind of the reality of it. So.
Many at the open house were upset about the possibility of burn bans, but longtime wood burner Don Nesbitt, who lives 5 miles outside North Pole, says that may be necessary in urban areas.
Ideally, I would like to see the cities around the schools and what have you controlled, and the people heating their homes on these fringes out left alone.
The state is proposing a localized approach in which control measures are focused on areas where pollution is concentrated. The state is suggesting a 56 microgram per cubic meter alert trigger, a threshold local air quality advocate Patrice Lee takes issue with.
It should be within the EPA guidelines of 35 micrograms or less. Second of all, we have to have enforcement. There has to be enforcement because people won't all voluntarily take their burning seriously and stop it when they need to.
Enforcement is one of several sticking points State Division of Air Quality Director Alice Edwards is working through.
We don't want to be in a situation where we have a regulation that says you can't burn if you that's the only way you have to heat your home. We want to be able to take into consideration things like it's 40 below, it's 50 below. We know that people need to supplement their heat with wood. A lot of people in this town have oil or some other form of base heat, but they use the wood to supplement.
Edwards reports a mix of public feedback on the proposed regulations, which would also ban the new installation of inefficient wood-burning appliances. She says the proposed regulations, developed in close consultation with the EPA, are designed to reduce pollution until cleaner burning, low-cost natural gas is available. That could be just a few years out under a state-subsidized project, but North Pole resident Jean Olson isn't convinced gas is the answer.
It's whatever the market will bear, and I think that money talks, and we'll have not such cheap natural gas when it finally does come. I don't think it'll be cheap enough to convince people to switch over and not burn wood.
The state will have two additional open houses on the proposed fine particulate pollution regulations before it begins formal hearings in January. The plan calls for a public process that will wrap up this spring with adoption of final regulations for incorporation into an implementation plan required by the EPA. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Juneau Assembly wants the city's Docks and Harbors Department to reconsider its decision not to use a project labor agreement for a major rebuild of the city's downtown cruise ship docks, scheduled to get underway next year. Docks and Harbors last month bid the project without a PLA, breaking from a long-standing city policy to use the agreements to the fullest extent of the law. The Assembly on Monday unanimously confirmed that policy. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
Randy Wanamaker was in his first stint on the Juneau Assembly in 2008 when the original policy statement supporting project labor agreements was adopted. In fact, he offered the motion then and says it was meant to apply to all city departments and enterprise boards.
It comes from the Assembly. It's not up to them to choose whether or not they wish to follow it.
That's Wanamaker speaking at this week's Juneau Assembly meeting, where Assemblymember Karen Crane introduced a motion confirming the PLA policy. While a project labor agreement does not require the city to hire a union contractor, it does set basic terms for wages, benefits, and working conditions. Assemblyman Jesse Keel says PLAs offer certain advantages.
When you look at our very large projects, our projects over $10 million, the on-time performance of projects with a PLA is dramatically better. It's night and day better than those without.
Crane's motion also requested the Docks and Harbors Department engage with the Juneau Building and Trades Council to resolve any issues that would prevent a PLA on the cruise ship dock project. Construction of two floating berths on the downtown waterfront is expected to take 2 years and cost the city $54 million. Keel says it's important for it to be done on time.
We saw this year the impact, and we'll see them in the budget, of missing cruise ships. They missed for mechanical reasons. Some skipped Southeast communities for weather reasons. And with these dock projects, we run the risk, if they're not delivered on time, of self-inflicted financial wounds.
CBJ Port Director Carl Yucatel previously said a labor agreement was not needed for the cruise ship dock project because the work is fairly simple and straightforward. He declined to comment Tuesday, saying he was still trying to understand the motion adopted by the Assembly. Juneau Building and Trades Council President Tom Bryce says the message he takes away is that while CBJ enterprise boards have a lot of autonomy, they still have to follow city policy. Bryce says other CBJ enterprises, such as Bartlett Regional Hospital and the Juneau Airport, have always included PLAs in major construction projects. He says Docks and Harbors' initial decision not to have an agreement for the cruise ship docks doesn't concern him moving forward.
No, not at all. I think the folks over at Docks and Harbors haven't had a lot of major projects come through their store. So as they use it, it will be something that they'll see a great deal of benefit from.
Wanamaker, who chairs the Assembly's Public Works and Facilities Committee, says he'll soon begin work to standardize the city's PLA review process. Right now, it's up to individual department heads to decide whether a project needs a labor agreement. Wanamaker believes a committee should do that analysis instead.
So that we provide a group reviewing rather than one person where arbitrariness or misunderstanding may occur.
The Assembly has asked City Attorney Amy Mead to come up with a draft review process. Courts have upheld the use of project labor agreements by government entities as long as they can justify a strong public interest. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Calling all Alaskan artists, Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
A survey taken this year of randomly selected Ketchikan women shows that half of the community's adult female population has experienced violence from a partner or sexual assault in their lifetime. The survey results were released during a public event Tuesday night in Ketchikan. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Out of every 100 adult women you see walking around in Ketchikan, 33 have been raped. And 43 have been slapped, hit, or worse by an intimate partner. When you combine those numbers, that means 50 of those 100 people we see every day has experienced one or both of those types of violence. Those aren't good numbers, but what's really sad is that they are conservative estimates and the real numbers likely are even worse. About 650 Ketchikan women took the phone survey, and the lead researcher, Andre Rosé of the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center, made a point of thanking them as he presented the findings.
Sadly, we made too many of them relive horrendous experiences, experiences that none of us should be subjected to, so that we could all understand the magnitude of this problem here in this community.
Also traveling to Ketchikan for the presentation were Lori Morton of the State Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and Katie Tipas, who coordinates the governor's Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Initiative. Morton says there have been a lot of different kinds of surveys over the years.
You hear a lot of different numbers that come from maybe law enforcement reports or maybe victim service providers or health and social services. This survey allows us to hear from the women themselves.
The first survey was 3 years ago, and it was statewide. Morton says it confirmed Alaska's high rates of domestic violence and sexual assault. The results show that close to 60% of women in Alaska have experienced one or the other. After that survey came out, Morton says people wanted to know about their regions in particular, so they adapted the survey process for smaller sections of the state and have been taking on about 3 per year.
So that you have an opportunity to know about the numbers in your region, and you can use that hopefully in 5 years from now when another survey is done to gauge whether or not the strategies in which you're working has made a difference.
The plan is to return to each region about 5 years after their initial survey to see whether rates of violence have changed. Rosé stressed that while the results are not positive, he hopes Ketchikan officials will use the information and move forward with prevention strategies. Morton repeated that hope and says there already are some proven programs in place offered by Women in Safe Homes and Ketchikan Indian Community. After the presentation, one of the audience members asked how Ketchikan compares to other regions that have been surveyed. Rosé says there's no way to accurately make such a comparison because of the limitations inherent to the survey.
They're all very, very close. Most of them are within the margin of error. But I think the safe conclusion is that the levels of violence are unacceptably high in every single region of Alaska.
and we have not yet found a region where we have low rates of violence.
Rosé says the goal is to get the numbers down to zero, and while he believes that is a goal that can be accomplished, it won't happen in his lifetime. Similar surveys have been conducted already in Anchorage, Fairbanks, the North Star Borough, Juneau, Dillingham, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, Sitka, Kodiak, the Mat-Su, and the Kenai Peninsula. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The state's first women's summit started in Anchorage today at Alaska Pacific University. The two-day event is directed at examining strategies to improve the lives of Alaska's women. Invited speakers include First Lady Sandy Parnell, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, and business leaders. In her remarks, Sandy Parnell called women the state's underdeveloped natural resource.
We are in the land of opportunity, with a solid economic foundation and state initiatives promoting jobs and strong families. So here's the paradox. While women are making great strides in our great land, many more struggle, their potential unrealized. And for my part, I want to speak of a particular area of devastating impact in the lives of women and girls. It's domestic violence, sexual assault, and child sexual abuse. I believe these are the greatest barriers to Alaska women achieving their potential.
The summit was organized in part by Senator Liesl McGuire, who last year commissioned a report on the status of women in Alaska with regard to housing, wages, mental health, domestic violence, and health care. The report revealed that on average, Alaskan women are paid less than women in the rest of the U.S., imprisoned at higher rates, and have a suicide rate that is twice the national average. But there is good news, too. The summit is also meant to highlight women's achievements and their success in the world of business. Karen Hagedorn is a production manager with ExxonMobil. She described how her company partners with the UN Foundation to sponsor research to find out what are the most important ways to improve women's economic productivity in different areas of the globe.
We know that a woman's economic status is one of the best indicators of whether her children will complete their education and will enjoy healthy, poverty-free lives. We know that when women are economically empowered, entire communities benefit. Jobs increase women's earnings, boost their self-esteem, improve their bargaining power at home, which is very important in many cultures, and also delay early marriage and pregnancy.
The Women's Summit continues through Friday at Alaska Pacific University. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Thousands of Alaskans have already gone through a home or commercial energy audit. These programs can identify ways to save a third on energy costs. For more energy and cost-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.